Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, we're talking about more Google hardware. We have reviewed the Chromecast with Google TV and the Nest Audio, and we are waiting so impatiently for the Pixel 5 to be released next week. We'll talk a little bit about what we know is coming. We also reviewed the Samsung Galaxy 20 FE, the low profile best phone of the year, question mark. We'll dig into why. The LG Wing is a swing and a miss, unfortunately, or maybe not, depending on how you feel about phones that swivel. And then towards the end of the show, we will dig into Google's antitrust snafus across the world. It's not just in the US that they're dealing with serious criticism about their monopolistic or reported and monopolistic practices. Joining me this week, Ara Wagner. Welcome back.
Yo.
Here to break down everything Google hardware related. You ready to do that?
I am absolutely ready to gush about the Chromecast with Google TV now that I have used it.
I'm excited to hear about your thoughts. And Jerry Hildenbrand, you weren't here last week. We missed you.
Well, I missed you too. I just had the sniffles and nobody wanted to hear me hack and sneeze for an hour.
No, especially since, nobody wants to be sick right now.
Right.
So I'm glad you're feeling a bit better.
Does anybody ever want to be sick ever? Except for maybe
no,
Super Bowl weekend?
But right now, I think it's a little bit more fraught than whenever.
Yeah.
Before this whole year just feels like one escalation after the other. So if you get sick, it's like it just knocks you off your, you know, everybody's on like rocky ground as it is, right? So if you get the sniffles, it just like knocks you into the water and you have to get yourself back up to the rocky ground. And, you know, that metaphor might not work for some people, but you know what I'm trying to say.
We got you. We got you, babe.
So, Ara, let's dig into some Google hardware. We reviewed the Chromecast with Google TV. This name continues to flummox me. You got one, and you've been using it for a few days. Joe did the review, and he said that Google just won the living room. So tell us about what it's like actually plugging it into a TV and using the thing.
Setting it up was pretty simple. You had an option for setting it up in the Google Home app or setting it up on device the way most Android TVs are set up. Setting up through the Google Home app actually didn't work for me, so I had to go through it manually and then, of course, log into all of your apps manually. That's always fun. But once you get things set up, the Google TV interface, for the most part, is pretty easy to work your way through as long as you have something at least general that you're aiming towards. If you just turn on your TV and like, I have no idea what I want to watch, it can still overwhelm you a little bit.
Talk about that experience. So it's recommending shows from different networks and services, over the top services. What do you see when you first log in that's different from, say, an NVIDIA Shield today?
Well, it's recommending stuff from services that I don't subscribe to. So every time that I've turned on my Google TV since I got it on Tuesday, it has popped up with a recommendation for Lovecraft Country, which is hilarious since I hate horror, but also hilarious because I do not subscribe to HBO Max, and I pushed the app as far down as I could because I couldn't completely uninstall it. Or if I have, I haven't found the setting for it yet.
Okay. So it's pushing you things that you don't currently have subscriptions to. It wants to upsell you in some way, but it's also giving you recommendations on content from services that you do have, like Netflix, like Disney Plus. So is it a better experience today in its early incarnation than Android TV on the, you know, on a NVIDIA Shield or one of the Android TV experiences built into an actual television?
For the regular user, I think it is a better experience. For people who are persnickety in particular about their experience, the way that I usually am, it's different, but I'm not sure if it's necessarily better. There are things that Google TV definitely is missing out on that other Android TVs have.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because this is the From what we understand, this is the de facto Android TV experience going forward. In a year or two, basically every Android TV product will have the Google TV overlay. And there's a couple questions here. The question is, why is Google doing this? You know, we know the answer. It's pushing services that you don't subscribe to so that it can upsell you and grab 30% of the cut. But Google also thinks that it's just a better lean back experience. And the, you know, the other thing is that this is Google TV. This is Google's flagship television experience, and it's separate from Android TV as the platform that developers can build experiences for. So, you know, walk us through what you think Google's rationale is for building an explicitly different overlay for existing Android TV hardware.
I think they wanted to consolidate the experience and have it be something that is easier for them to augment and improve as time goes on. Because right now, for updating the home screens on a Google on an Android TV, it'll take months for it to reach most models, assuming it comes to most models at all, as evidenced by the fact that them injecting ads onto the home screen has not reached the majority of NVIDIA Shield TVs, because NVIDIA is very protective about what software pushes out to their set-top boxes. But at the same time, I mean, it's a different perspective, and I like the fact that Google has recognized that, oh, hey, this one feature that we had in the Google Play Movies and TV app for 4 years, we can use that on a TV to make it easier for everybody to watch what they want to watch. Because as long as we have had, for several years now, Google Play Movies and TV, if you go to a movie listing, you can see whether or not you want to watch this in Google Play Movies and TV or Netflix or Hulu or whatever else it's tied into. And the fact that they've expanded that and turned that into the launcher for Android TV now is useful.
Maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist. Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. But,
maybe.
I think everything every company does, not just Google, that's connected and has a user interface is all about analytics. This included. Look at what Google knows by using this new, let's call it a launcher, I guess. It knows what services you don't have, what services you do, what services you've looked at because you saw content you liked, what type of content you like, when you look for content to consume. That's all valuable stuff for partners.
It is, but I don't think it's learning as quickly as you would think, Jerry. Mostly because I've spent, of the things that I have watched on my on the and Google TV since I have set it up, the majority of it has been reruns for SVU. And yet, every time I log in, the first row of recommendations is mostly Disney Plus and Netflix. And
well,
very little
knows
from
you really well.
Well, no, because I've watched maybe one thing on Netflix in the last 2 weeks, and Disney Plus I've maybe watched two or three different things in the last week and a half to 3 weeks, and it didn't recommend either of them.
I hear you, and I also, I guess I should have said, the learning part is secondary. The primary part is data collection.
That I will agree with. But I'm also somebody who is, hasn't been clicking on recommendations through the Google TV app. I'm still somebody who I prefer to go into the app itself and pick what I want to watch. So that might be why the data collection hasn't quite caught up on me yet.
Yeah, I mean, look, Google is learning from the experience of running algorithms. Its main product is Google Search. It is run by an algorithm that adapts to you and in your browsing history. YouTube is just one huge algorithm. It recommends content so that you will keep watching. This feels like this is Google doing the same thing in a lean back experience, that you basically queue up a whole bunch of content. And once you're finished something, you may be likely to go with a recommendation based on what you've previously watched. And because Google is the only company to have gotten Netflix through the through that barrier of consolidating all of its content into the For You section, Apple famously couldn't get Netflix to agree to terms to be in its TV app. So if you're sitting in you know, watching your Apple TV, you will not get Netflix recommendations in that app. And that makes it a pretty bad experience because I don't know about you, but half of the things I watch are on Netflix, at least.
Yeah.
So with Netflix content imbued into the lean back for you experience, I feel like as long as you subscribe to a few different services, Hulu, Netflix, Disney Plus, you know, maybe Peacock or HBO Max, you will never run out of things to watch. And if Google can learn about your watching habits well enough, it will do for lean back TV watching for over the top services what it did with YouTube. And it's exactly what makes YouTube so addictive.
I haven't been able to use mine yet because my AV receiver is ancient and doesn't have a new enough HDMI standard. And it's an encryption thing. It's just me with old junk. And I don't have anywhere else to plug it in. But what I've seen of it, I think I'm going to like the interface. It's, you know, maybe it needs tweaked. Era's telling us it's not perfect for her. And, you know, I'm sure it's not. Look how bad even the App Store was for a year or two about finding you content you actually cared about. But I like that it reminds me enough of the Netflix experience on a big screen that I really like, that I think I'll also like it on this Google TV, Chrome, whatever they end up calling it, you know, overlay, whatever. But maybe not today. I got to buy new stuff. I hate buying new stuff.
Well, you can do that next week.
If it's only $50, then, you know, it's actually, that's the other part of this conversation, right? This is only $50. It's $30 cheaper than the Chromecast Ultra when it came out, and it does not skimp on the hardware. It doesn't support fewer standards. It's still a 4K streaming device. In fact, I've seen evidence that apps on this look better. I mean, it's no surprise that YouTube, 4K YouTube looks better on the Chromecast with Google TV than it does on the Apple TV, but it does, and it's important that it does because in addition to Netflix, YouTube is a very popular lean back TV experience right now, and Google has the new, I think it's the AV1 codec on there. It's just a better quality, lower bandwidth experience if you're watching it on a Chromecast.
Right, and the price you hit on there, that's important. It's going to cost me more money to buy the cables I need than it did to buy the device that would just work if I had a normal setup. So that's important. You know, Google has went on the record saying it knows that times are tough for a lot of people and that, you know, hardware prices matter and service prices matter, and them releasing something that has been as well received as this has, which tells me that it's good. At the price they have it, you know, anything under $50 is still an impulse buy for most people.
Yeah, and this will be going down to $40 for Prime Day and Black Friday, I believe, based on some leaked information that we saw at Android Police last week. So at $40, this is really just Google subsidizing the hardware so that it can get you to subscribe to YouTube TV, which we didn't even talk about, Ara. Like, live TV is a big component of this product, and it is very prominent on Google TV in a way that it isn't in the Android TV experience.
Well, it's only prominent if you're already a YouTube TV subscriber. Otherwise, you just see the icon in your carousel for YouTube TV, but the tab itself won't appear unless you actually have an active subscription. And since YouTube TV starts at $65 a month now, a month of YouTube TV is more expensive than the new Chromecast, which is mind-boggling.
Absolutely, but it's still cheaper than a lot of cable subscriptions.
Oh, yeah.
And the argument here is that if you have everything in one place, right, if your For You tab is right next to your Live tab, and you can just scroll back and forth between Over the Top and Live Television, watch Netflix and YouTube, and then transition over to YouTube TV when you want to, you know, have gouge your eyes out at the next presidential debate or something like that, then that's your prerogative. And it's something that Google does very well. Roku does it very well as well. And, you know, to some extent, Apple does too. But I think this is, from what I understand, the best combination because that For You tab integrates every service that you care about. And YouTube TV is so well integrated into this Chromecast.
Well, Google TV only integrates content from, I think it was either 13 or 17 apps right now. And granted, that'll cover them. That covers most of the big ones, except for, I think, Peacock. Peacock isn't actually integrated the way it's supposed to be yet. We need to see wider adapt. We need to see more services that buy into the Google TV and having the recommendations front and center, especially from more niche subscriptions.
Like what? What's missing here that you would like added today?
VRV, which it's hilarious that they have Crunchyroll and Funimation in this, but not VRV, which is what most anime and I'm guessing gaming nerds, but mostly anime subscribers would subscribe to instead of doing either of those services individually.
I don't know what that is.
VRV is a combination of subscription. It gets you five different services: Rooster Teeth, High Dive, Crunchyroll, Boomerang, so it has like old school like Scooby-Doo cartoons, but also things like PBS. PBS has not been spitting out recommendations yet. I've only been logged into that app for a day, but it hadn't pulled up any of the stuff in my watch list from there either.
I see. So it has some of the individual services within VRV, but not all of them.
Yes. And yeah, especially, but I'm sure that there are others. I mean, we only have 17 apps that will tie into it right now. And most of those are either major subscriptions that have millions of customers or have a free tier that millions of people use.
All right. So here's my question. Why go and buy the $129 NVIDIA Shield today versus the Chromecast with Google TV? What separates NVIDIA's Android TV experience? I'm not even talking about the Pro, which has beefier hardware and more storage and comes with a controller. Just the base NVIDIA Shield. Why buy that over this at this point?
Technically speaking, they're getting close to being even, which means that the Google TV will win on price. I trust NVIDIA more long term, mostly because the NVIDIA Shield that I have in my apartment is a 2015 NVIDIA Shield and it still gets regular updates. So I trust NVIDIA for the long haul more than I trust Google, because Google's living room devices traditionally do not have that long of a support life.
I think maybe it's ecosystem too. And that goes for me a lot, because I use an NVIDIA video card. I use their game streaming service. The Shield fits into that very small, very niche ecosystem really, really well. And I think because NVIDIA makes most of their money with PC gaming equipment, that they'll continue to support a device that helps buffer that ecosystem.
Okay, so I just want to figure out the Google TV has a AM Logic S905D3 quad core ARM A55 processor with a Mali G31 dual core GPU, 2 gigs of RAM, and 8 gigs of storage. So, Jerry, I'm sure you don't know that chip off the top of your head, but comparing that to the Tegra X1 Plus inside the NVIDIA Shield series.
Like comparing apples to broccoli, not even apples to oranges. That's a okay. Good. You're right. I don't know that exact model, but AM Logic, that's a good generic ARM processor for small smart devices like the Chromecast with Google TV. Great processor for that. It's not good for gaming, or if you were, if your TV wasn't the thing that was actually doing the final rendering for HDR. You wouldn't want to depend on that little chip to do everything, but I'm sure it does what it needs to do really well, and it's cheap.
I was wondering why things were taking longer to go from standard definition to the HDR when I was watching stuff the last 2 days. That explains it.
Yeah, your TV does a lot of the final processing, no matter what you're feeding into it.
Yeah. Things would start playing and they would be a little bit blurry, and then like a minute or two later, they would finally get clear.
Right, because it's decoding right. The HDR, the 4K HDR signal, right?
Well, I don't have 4K. Just 1080p, it was taking like 2 minutes to go from. And
if you had a way to measure it, you'd probably see like a tiny bit of lag in the audio channel. It's not perfect, but it doesn't have to be perfect. It's more than good enough.
Right.
Yeah.
And also Stadia, right? We're talking about
right.
Why is Stadia not on this yet? Stadia has nothing to do with the hardware on the Chromecast itself, but the app obviously has to be optimized for this platform
right.
To some extent. And we're still waiting for Google to figure that out. In the meantime, you can sideload Stadia. It works. And it's not great, but it works. So you can play it to your heart's content. It yep. works better, apparently, on the Chromecast Ultra, which is still on sale. And I believe it's only going to be bundled with the Stadia Premier Edition going forward. So you may not be able to find it on its own anymore, but if you want Stadia, for the next few months at least, it'll come bundled with the Chromecast Ultra, not the Chromecast with Google TV. Just a heads up. Any last thoughts on the Chromecast, Ara?
I wish the remote had 3 more buttons.
Which buttons?
Dedicated play pause, dedicated fast forward, dedicated rewind. Just because there are too many apps like PBS and Disney Plus and VRV that don't have, it's not instantly press left or right to fast forward or rewind. They have proprietary UIs that require you to press extra buttons in order to fast forward or rewind a certain amount. So having dedicated buttons for that would make my life easier, because I'm somebody who very much is I will skip to the scenes that I like and skip over the scenes that are cringeworthy.
Try voice commands just to satisfy
I've
my
done
curiosity.
That in some apps. It's not supported in all of them.
Well, maybe today's news will change that.
Maybe.
Or just deal with the cringe.
Well, that's I wasn't going to say it, but
well,
you know, I'm going to watch something. I'm going to watch it.
Walk away. Just walk out of the room. Come
go
back when
beer.
You know that the cringe is over.
Nah, I just mute it and look down at my phone.
Those scenes were designed for you to get up and go get another bottle of beer.
Right. It's instead of commercials. Netflix shows just have set amount of cringe in them so that you have an excuse to check your phone and
let's all go
refill
to the
your beer.
Lobby. They should just do that.
Do, 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 do. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Nest Audio. So I reviewed this. I don't know what to say about it. It's great. Like it's really good. It's got everything you need in a $100 speaker. It's very flat. So Jerry, I think this would be a good speaker for you. It doesn't bias any of the audio that you're playing. It's got really good auto EQ, so it knows the kind of music or the kind of signal that's coming into it, and it'll adjust the EQ accordingly. So podcasts sound more vocal forward than regular music, for instance.
Yeah. Your review really impressed me. I didn't just say that to suck up to the boss or anything when I told you that. So if you have any questions, if you consider yourself maybe not a full out audiophile, but you don't want a speaker that sounds like crap, you totally need to read Daniel's review, because he tells you how that thing's going to sound in a way that you're going to understand it. And I walked away completely knowing that I still wish they made a Chromecast audio, because I have, you know, standing floor speakers that I spent way too much money on and use a Chromecast audio with them. But this seems like it's a good enough substitute that almost everyone is going to love it.
Yeah, I would say that. I would love it to be a little bigger and the woofer to be slightly more low-end heavy. Like, there is bass but it's unlike something like the Echo, which leans right. heavily on the woofer, and the bass is very sloppy. Like, it just fills the room with bad quality low end.
That I
and
heard
it overshadows every other part of the signal. Whereas this is even. It's very, very flat. It's very neutral. But if you want to listen to bass heavy content, even if you EQ it to hell and turn the bass all the way to 11, it does not actually have that much impact. So there's two solutions to that. The one is you just buy, and this neither of them are perfect. The one is that you just buy a second Nest Audio, right? And you pair them in stereo mode, and then you do get a fair amount of very high quality bass.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that you don't buy the Nest Audio and you buy the Google Home Max, which it may be 3 years old, but it's now only $250, and it really is a good product.
I was speaking to someone else, and they explained it to me as it's like using open back headphones. The bass is there,
yeah.
But you don't
that's
have
a really good
thump.
Way to put
it's
it.
It's more like a whoosh.
Yeah.
Living in an apartment, not having any thump is a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. Look, I see why Google did what it did. They wanted to hit that $100 price point, and objectively, this thing sounds night and day better than the Google Home. Objectively, it sounds night and day better than the Amazon Echo third gen. So obviously, we don't have the fourth gen Echo to compare it to. It's coming out in a couple of weeks. The second I get one, I will compare the two. What I did, though, is so the Sunday afternoon before the embargo lifted, I spent about an hour on just listening to the Echo third gen, a Sonos One, the Nest Audio, and the original Google Home. And I went into Spotify and I went back and forth between these four speakers. I would listen to 30 seconds of a song on one. I would transfer it to another song, another speaker. I would go back to that same spot, listen to it again. So it was as, you know, apples to apples as I could get. And the Nest Audio sounded, you know, like it was like Sonos One at like 9, Amazon or Nest Audio at like 8, and then Amazon Echo at like 5, and Google Home at like 2 in terms of quality. So really, really huge upgrade over the Google Home.
Well, you know, for streaming music, it's probably and I hate to say this too, because everybody's ears are different, but when you're streaming music, you probably won't notice anything much better. If it's that close in quality to a Sonos One, that's going to be good enough when you're streaming music.
Agreed. 100% agree. And I would recommend, if you care about Google Assistant at all, like using it with your voice, you don't buy the Sonos One. The Sonos One is a bad smart speaker, even though it has microphones and it supports Google Assistant. Just don't. It's not worth it. If you want to go that route, buy two Nest Audios, pair them together. You have a fantastic Google Assistant experience and a great stereo pair that you can use for basically anything.
Or we start a petition to bring back the Nexus Q. Do it.
Well,
I'll sign.
the Amazon Echo 4th Gen already looks enough like the Nexus Q that you don't need it.
Nexus Q with tiger face paint.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, you bash the tiger. The tiger and the panda are cute.
The Echo 4 is going to sound good too. I'm almost sure of it.
It'll sound better for sure. The reason it will is I believe Amazon is using the same tweeter and woofer combination as
just
on the
about.
Third gen, but they're directional now. So
yes,
the Amazon Echoes have always been 360 degrees. The tweeter would face up and the woofer would face down. And as a result, the radiators would push audio out to all sides of the room, right? It was not directional, which did impact the quality of the signal, or the quality of the output. This year, it's the first year the Echo is directional, and that makes a big difference in how you hear what you're listening to.
Because even with the subwoofer, the Amazon third gen, you could see an improvement, but it just wasn't it wasn't for really good for listening to music. It just wasn't.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, Amazon, the studio, the Echo Studio sounds pretty damn good, but it's also $200. So I didn't really include it in, and it's massive. It's in a different like size class, price class, all that stuff.
That's two Nest Audios for better sound.
Exactly. All right, let's move on to talk about this new Google Assistant integration that came out today. We're recording this on October 8th, Thursday. Google unveiled a whole bunch of stuff at its developer day. One of them is that Google Assistant is now integrating more, I would say it's more native in the apps that it supports. So yes. Things like Spotify, things like Nike Run, Nike Run Club, Walmart, Snapchat, Postmates. You can say like, you know, hey, G, order me a smoothie from X Cafe on Postmates. And instead of just opening Postmates, it'll get you as close to the end of the transaction as possible, which is pretty interesting. And Google is also adding these action intents to allow any developer to do the same with their app down the road. So Jerry, walk us through exactly what this is.
Well, it's pretty much that part of their announcement today is exactly what you described. They've given developers the tools to build Assistant actually as part of their app, where you don't just say, skip this song, or, you know, you don't just say, hey, G, play this song. You talk to the app, your music player app, and you tell it, you know, whatever the developer wanted you to do, skip forward 15 seconds if you're ERA and don't want to listen to something, a part of a song. You can just tell it to do these things, and it just does them. It doesn't need to query any type of, you know, external source, whether it be, you know, on-device machine learning or the cloud. It can just do these things because the developer of the app told it how to do it. And it this goes beyond apps. Google was very excited to tell us how much better this will work, especially in Android, but in some iOS apps as well. And they didn't come out and say it, but I assume that means the Gmail app and the Chrome app, you know, Google's apps on iOS. But for the web, for, you know, your smart display, for if you build out a scrolling smart billboard using, you know, Google's cloud platform, and you can connect it to Assistant, those kind of things can be programmed to do the same thing. Assistant just it finally became a platform today. It's no longer just an add-on. It's its own platform.
So there's a couple of assumptions here. The one assumption is that people use Assistant on their phones at all, yeah, right? Which I'm sure Google has a lot of data to support. They wouldn't have continue to build up this integration unless people did use it on their phones. The other is that people want voice intent to replace physical taps on their phone in some instances, right? And that's where I get hung up on this feature, right? Because I don't usually think of asking Google to order me a smoothie on Postmates as being faster than just going into Postmates and doing it myself. But this could just be that I have been educated in a certain way, right, around using my phone. And people who may be more voice native are learning how to use their phones in a hybrid way. So I wonder, Ara, are you interested in something like this? Do you think that this will change the way that you use your apps, or some people in your life, how they would use their apps? Like, what do you think about this?
I'm not entirely sure that it's going to change that much for regular users right now. I think this is a matter of it's going to make it easier for you to start using Google Assistant more often, because like you, Daniel, the place I use Assistant the most often is in the car with Android Auto. And Yes, Jerry, the ones I use most often are next song, rewind 90 seconds, fast forward 3 minutes.
Yeah.
But being able to have it integrate with your apps more, having it able to integrate with services more easily than having to go through and find it through that assistant, whatever portal it was in the app, where you could hook things, hook services into assistant. Having it be something that's seamless and can be done without having to dig into any menus at all is going to be a very much a godsend for regular users.
Well, what I think there is Google knows, a little bit about the people that do use Assistant, but it doesn't know much about the people that don't, especially why they don't. This just gave every developer that wants to be a partnership with Google Assistant, and maybe the person who writes the app you love to use will find a way that you do want to use Assistant. And Google just doesn't know that. But this other developer knows how you use his app and knows that, you know, if there was an easy way to tell Assistant to just do this feature, do X, and it would just do X, people would like that. Whereas Google isn't going to know that kind of metrics about how we use the apps on our phones or other connected devices.
So, you know, this is opening up with just a handful of supported partners, as Google's calling them, but obviously this will eventually be part of Android. And it's interesting that Google is explicitly saying that this is an Android-first experience.
Right.
Clearly, they don't have control over iOS in nearly close to the same way Siri is the voice assistant on iOS. But it's obvious here that Google is trying to add value to all Android purchases, right? You buy an Android phone, it doesn't matter which one, as long as it has Google services, it has this assistant baked in. That's part of the agreement that manufacturers sign with Google when they let them put Android on their phones. And now this just comes free, so that you can add this assistant, this deep sort of integration with native apps. But I'm also interested in this idea that Google's making it easy for apps to show off features of their show off features of their apps by using these action intents. So, for instance, you can build a demo of, like, they're using Snapchat's lenses here as an example. You can build a demo, so you can say, like, try out the funny clown lens or something, and all you need to do is just say, hey G, show me Snapchat, you know, clown lens. God forbid anybody want to make themselves into a clown, but you know what I'm saying. And it will just go straight to that experience. And the best experiences are the ones where you don't have to go through a login screen, you don't have to sign up at all. You just go straight into that. And I can see this pairing nicely with, either very light apps or apps that you don't have to install at all, that you can just try through the Play Store and, you know, just use them then and there. So if I'm not sure if I want to play a game, I can just download a sliver of that game, say go, you know, and then the app can say, you know, tell Google to go into this experience or whatever, and you can try it out without actually spending a lot of time or bandwidth on it. And to me, that's where this will be really handy.
You know, I'm waiting for the first developer, since you mentioned games, maybe I'm just a game nerd. Android games are getting really good, especially, you know, as we move to bigger and bigger screens. The first developer of a high-end 3D Android game that integrates Assistant. So, you know, like you're talking to GLaDOS or, you know, talking to your Pip-Boy or something like that, and makes it part of an immersive experience like that. I can't wait to see that, just to see how things like that are going to work.
I'm excited. I'm always cautious about when Google adds a bunch of Google Assisted features, because I'm rarely as impressed when they finally roll out as when they demo them on stage. But this one does seem like it'll be useful. So, here's hoping. All right, let's talk about this Galaxy S20 FE. So I'm curious, you know, I have one, and it's something that I've been really impressed by. I think Google has, you know, or Samsung rather, has really undermined its own strategy to some extent by making the FE as good as it is. And it's, you know, the next Galaxy SE in the line is $999. This is $699, but you can find it for $599 right now. Ara, you're on tap to receive one, I believe, in a few days.
It came in today.
Oh, it did? Okay, which color did you get?
Red. It's going to be so pretty at Christmas time.
That is really one of the selling points of this, is it's available in like six really nice colors. Samsung made cuts where it felt it could get away with them, and it seems to work, right? The 6 gigs of RAM doesn't appear to slow the phone down very much. The changes to the camera sensors are understandable and actually tolerable because you get a much smaller camera bump than on the other S20s. The battery is very, very large, and due to the 1080p screen, it lasts all day and then some. And there's a flat display, and I'm so happy that a Galaxy has a flat display that I don't actually think I'm going to go back to using a phone with a curved display if I can help it, because this is just 120 hertz plus flat display. Yeah. Feels like a panacea to me.
Well, I, you know, when they released this, now all the takes about don't buy the regular Galaxy Note 20, you're going to get ripped off. Now they all make sense. You know, I mean,
they all made sense when the Note 20 was released. Yeah. Note 20 was a ripoff.
Well, I mean, not if you wanted the... Anyway, if you wanted a Note, it was the cheaper way to get into one, was the way I always saw that, is at least you're saving a few hundred dollars. But now they've made this, I get it. I mean, man, the S Pen is not worth it over this phone. I don't even have one, but I talk to people all day long that have one, and they'll all tell you that this is a damn good phone. It's not a compromise. It's a damn good phone.
It's a damn big phone.
Is it? Like,
I thought it was the size of the S20. No, it's the size of like the S20 Plus.
It is. Yeah, it's a 6.5 inch, so it is bigger than the regular S20.
Yeah, no, I saw S20 FE and thought, oh, cool, they made a better version of the small one. Nope. Mm.
But he pointed out the two benefits there. Big flat display, great big battery.
Yeah, I mean, what does the S20 have? It has a 4,000 or 4,500 milliamp? I forget. But it's not as big as this one. And this one does a great job. I find it interesting, right, that Samsung appears to have understood its pricing model this year just did not work. And in another year, maybe an FE would have cost $899 or $799. But right now it doesn't. It costs $699 because they know that, you know, like Google, they can't be releasing $1,000 phones and expecting the same sales numbers. Unfortunately, Samsung already released a whole bunch of 1,000 plus phones and then decided to go ahead with this one, making the other ones, especially the regular Note 20, just feel oppressively overpriced. And right now, you can actually find the Note 20 for $800, so it's $200 off. But yeah, I still wouldn't recommend it unless you really need the S Pen. So,
who really needs the S Pen? I mean, it's, unless you're an artist or somebody who just fat fingers everything, how useful is the stylus on the Note 20?
Well, there's use cases. We can't say that nobody needs it. You know, you can use it to take inventory in a warehouse or something like that.
Yeah, no, that's what I meant by...
But most people, it's a cool addition, and that's about it. I agree with you there.
So I've been using something called a Remarkable 2 the last few days, which is it's basically, they call it a paper tablet, but it's an e-paper mm-hmm. based tablet, and it comes with a stylus. You have to use it with a stylus. Like, it will not work without one. And it's essentially just an e-ink notebook and you take notes on it, but it's a very large canvas. And it's the reason that I feel comfortable using it is because of its large canvas. The same reason that I love writing on the iPad Pro with an Apple Pencil or the Galaxy Tab S7 with the S Pen, it's because it feels large enough. You don't have to cramp your hands to write comfortably. And I've always found that with the Galaxy Note, even as it got larger over the years and the actual screen got bigger, I still never found it easy to type long or to write long form on it in a way that made me not just want to pull out a pad of paper and a pen. So I agree with you to some extent, but I have really, really come to enjoy writing again over the last few days as I've been as I've been testing the Remarkable 2 tablet. And it's making me want to go back to the Note 20 Ultra and use it with the S Pen, because there are just so many things that I feel more comfortable writing than typing.
But did you feel that comfortable when you were using the Note 20 Ultra?
No, it's not big enough. I didn't. But you know, I'm wondering if it's like, if it just needed, if my brain just needed a shift using something a little bit more
maybe
purpose-built for a stylus, if you will. But maybe not. Maybe I'll go back to the Note 20 Ultra and be like, this is ridiculous. Why would I use this?
Well, you totally need to do it, so we know, man.
But I mean, there's something to be said about, I've heard from so many people that using a Galaxy Note makes their life easier. Using the S Pen improves their life tremendously, and they will never go back. But are those people willing to spend $1,000 every year now, or every 3 or 4 years? I don't know. Maybe not.
I hope this works well for Samsung. I hope the fan edition is wildly popular, and it puts enough incentive into Samsung's coffers to do repeats every year.
Well, you know, okay, so here's the thing. Galaxy, this was, I believe, based on what we heard, originally going to be called the Galaxy S20 Lite. Samsung released a Note 10 Lite and an S10 Lite, but they did market research and a bunch of polling, and they found that people thought of light as a lesser adjective. If something is light, it's lesser than. So they went with FE because fan edition, I don't know why, but sure, marketing. So from that perspective, I get it. It's basically just a successor to the Galaxy S10 Lite, which was also a pretty decent product. The difference is they now have to reproduce this every year. And as Samsung is wont to do, it increases the price of its flagships year after year, and it's getting further and further away from the mainstream with its flagship products. So that's what I'm curious about, is how long can it sustain the growth in pricing at the high end while also maintaining the mid-range, while also trying to appease the budget market with its Galaxy A lineup, which now that it has 5G is also kind of expensive. So it's just like Samsung has too many phones, is what I'm saying.
Samsung's had too many phones for 5 years.
But that's like saying Chevy has too many cars.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, Chevy can sell a Corvette, and it can sell a Cobalt.
Be like Tesla and only make one car. No, I'm joking. Don't be like Tesla. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? There are people who want both. You know, and I mean, there's probably people who want both at the same time. But I mean, there are people who want that Corvette, and there are people who want the Cobalt, and I don't know what mid-range car Chevy makes anymore. Malibu? Do they still make the Malibu?
Impala.
There are people who want these, and they like the price that's being offered. I don't think that Samsung necessarily has to make less phones. They need to find a way to make sure they can take care of all the phones they have out there, instead of ignoring a few of the ones that, you know, we don't talk about much. But I just hope that they realize that people are willing to wait 6 months for a version of a phone that's almost as good as the one they showed us in February that cost $1,200, but it only cost $600. because this everything I see about that phone tells me it's a great freaking Android phone.
It is. And it's also going to get 3 years of updates, which is another thing entirely, right? It's another thing entirely because, as you argued in August and Ryan Hager, friend of the pod over at Android Police, argued today, Google needs to increase the amount of time it supports its products to 5 years at least. And with Samsung promising 3 years, not just of security patches, but platform updates, and the fact that mainline is actually catching on now, and it is really making it easier for manufacturers to update their phones longer, Google needs to set the standard. And the thing is that if you charge $1,300 for a phone, it's easier to swallow if you're upgrading after 5 years than you are after one or two. So that can be, that argument can be made, and I think manufacturers will continue to make it, but then they have to follow up with it by supporting their phones longer.
Well, maybe if they made fewer phones and focused on support for more of them for longer.
Yeah. Well, that's something that Samsung has heard loud and clear from basically all of us in the industry.
I agree. Samsung has learned and become the phone OEM that Android needs, in my opinion. They've matured into, this is Android. It's been that way financially for a long time.
Pixel.
Yeah, this is, I haven't been excited about a Samsung phone in a long time, but the S20 Fan Edition, it's just, if you are looking for a new phone and you have the funds to buy a new phone, I think that's probably the one you need to look at first.
Yeah. No, 100%. Samsung is Android for most people, and what it does. I mean, just based on the traffic to Android Central the last few days, like, this is probably going to be one of the most popular phones of the year.
Good.
If not the most popular phone of the year. So, that just speaks for itself. And speaking of another phone that is kind of in the complete opposite direction, the LG Wing. So I want to talk about this before we get to the antitrust stuff. Alex Dobie reviewed the LG Wing this week. He said it is definitely the weirdest phone of 2020. And I would agree with that. I have one. It's very well made. It's a very ambitious phone. The software does not hold up to the ambition, though. It just does. It does not do enough to take advantage of the dual screen. But I love it. It's fascinating, and if LG ever gets around to caring about software the way that they do about hardware, this could be a very interesting form factor.
I get so tired of hearing that about LG year after year. Don't you?
I mean, LG, like,
I agree with you.
Go read the review.
Stop saying it when it's not true anymore.
I agree with it. LG just needs to get their blank together. Totally.
And look, LG's, like, we have this every time we review an LG phone, because, everybody's like, if this was a Samsung product, you would give it a 5-star and say that you should buy it right now. But the thing is with Samsung, when they make a foldable or they try to approach a new form factor, they give an S about the actual software experience. And I would say that by, LG defaulting to a Rolodex app launcher when you turn this horizontal is probably all you need to know about what they think this phone is going to be used for in that dual screen mode. Like, it is just the most bare bones basic experience you can imagine, and it's just not good enough. Like, LG really needs to rethink how it approaches Android software. And they've been saying it for years and years, and it has not come to fruition. So I don't want to give them a pass on.
And you shouldn't.
A really good piece of hardware that you need to, if you're somebody like our friend, Juan Carlos Bagnell, who just loves digging into the nitty gritty of a product, and will do everything to make this a manual phone, manual camera, manual, setting up all the dual display combinations, trying to find the right ingredients to make this something worth buying, by all means. But I don't know if most people are going to care about that. So that's what I'm saying. And I know I'm going to get emails from people telling me that I'm not giving it a chance. I hear you. The difference is that I have one of these. I have really tried to use it. I have a Surface Duo, and I think the Duo does a better job than LG about, you know, about thinking about software. So, you know, I just want, I want people to know that I'm not just dismissing it because it's LG. I really did give this thing a chance, and I want it to get better.
And I can tell you here at AC, we all love LG's hardware. There's a long-running joke about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, I was on a camping trip, and we used a LG smartphone to drive the tent stakes into the ground. We literally used it as a hammer because we couldn't find a rock, and it was fine. LG makes some of the best equipment you can buy, but it seems like the software improvements come at a pace where they're 5 years too late.
Yeah, I mean, that's so. Here's what I want to know. If you are interested in buying an LG Wing, or you're already an LG phone user, if you've been using a V60 or a Velvet or something, send us an email, podcast@Android Central. Tell us why you love LG today over something, you know, from Samsung or Google or Sony or whatever. Is it the headphone jack? This one doesn't have one. Is it the battery life? Is it the camera quality? Because this isn't that. This is not a great camera compared to the V60. This just has a lot of mid-range specs with one interesting gimmick that the software does not take advantage of. So that's where I'm going to leave it. And you can email me your hate mail, because that's what I'm sure will happen. All right, let's talk a little bit about this antitrust report. The House, the Democrats, and then two House Republicans factions issued three separate reports this week, targeting antitrust from Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. We'll focus mostly on the Google stuff here, but if you want to read a really good overview of all four of these companies, we are linking to a Verge overview, so go read that. Jerry, let's talk about what this antitrust report says about Google in particular, and what remedies it is hoping for if the laws are changed.
Well, the biggest issue that the world has with Google is the way all of their services, even services you don't think about, are connected to each other. And that doesn't mean that, oh, Google reads data from the way I use Chrome to show me ads. No, I don't even mean that. I mean the way Google places ads in search, for example. That's a big problem. The not just the United States, the world doesn't like that, because it really looks like Google has a huge advantage and it's abusing it. Google says they're not, and of course they're going to say they're not. But come on, Google owns search. Google has, you know, Chrome, which is the most used browser of all of them. Android is, you know what, on almost 80% of the phones out there are Android phones. Google has all of this. Google is using something to its own advantage somewhere. Even if it's not trying to, it is. Unfortunately, these reports and these types of things take so long to happen that we're going to find that Google has addressed some of the line item issues that this particular investigation is looking at. Google has probably changed the way it charges customers on a per item search, ad insertion, or something minor that came up as an unfair practice. And that's going to be, okay, Google addressed it and forgotten. But then there's 10 other things that Google's doing that nobody's even found yet. Because of the way Google's structured, it lends itself to have an unfair advantage. I'm not going to say that's a bad thing. I don't like it, but I understand how capitalism is supposed to work. Google earned that advantage by making products that people really want to use. I also see how unfair it is to other companies that will never be able to build products as popular because Google owns the space. I don't think some of the recommendations of let's break up Alphabet even further are the right answer, but I don't have the right answer. I don't know how you fix it.
I think more oversight is a good step in that direction. Although we've done so much deregulation in tech and commerce over the last 20 years, I really don't know where you would begin.
That's good. There does need to be more oversight, but in the right areas and for the right things. Seeing, you know, the two sides in our government fight over stupid things like bias against one political party. Who cares? Shut up. Shut up and do your job, Congress, and find ways that Google is hurting consumers and other small businesses by abusing its market power, and stop playing the fool. That's a good first step.
Well, it doesn't help that one of the biggest ways to interfere with companies like this getting as big as they have, the approval of mergers and acquisitions, have just been relatively effortless for Google and Amazon and all these others to just buy up company after company for the last 10 years, especially during the last five.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's something that I think every company does. And it's just it comes through the fact that, like, in order to grow, you kind of have to buy companies. It's just the way that you grow in this market. It's not.
Yeah, but there's a difference between growing and copy, acquire, kill. And copy, acquire, kill should not be the de facto playbook for everything.
And some companies just shouldn't be able to buy other companies because it does nothing but create an unfair advantage. Anything that has anything at all to do with search or online ads just needs to be hands off to Google completely. Google is not allowed to purchase any more technology that does that. They have enough.
So what's happening right now is we're waiting for the regulators in various countries, including the EU, including the continent of the EU, to approve Google's purchase of Fitbit. Google is currently being sued in three different courts by Sonos for patent infringement. Google is under scrutiny by the Justice Department for its antitrust. It's being, you know, the House issued this report and is looking into changing the laws. They're looking maybe to change Section 230 to make these platforms liable for content posted on these platforms. Google is under investigation in both China and India for anti-competitive practices, including in India, where it has been accused of preventing TV makers from making non-Google based smart TVs if they make an Android TV, if they sell an Android TV. They're also not apparently allowed to make Android TVs that are built on forks of Google, built on forks of Android. So they have to use the sanctioned Android TV experience with all the Google services that are built in, rather than allowing manufacturers to build kind of offshoots of Android, which is very common.
I totally believe that Google is doing that because Google did it before in the United States with Acer. When Acer wanted to release a device that ran Windows and Android on the same device, and Google said, no, if you do that, we're throwing you out of the Open Handset Alliance and you're not going to get a license to use our services. Google has done that, probably is doing it, and they need shredded. They need fined big enough to make sure they don't ever do it again. But that has nothing to do with Section 230. Congress needs to stop being idiots.
Yes, 230 needs to be left the hell alone because it really doesn't. It's not on the company so long as the company has proper moderation. 230 is about we don't like what a website is doing. We want to be able to sue the website because of what a user does. And that's crap.
And we didn't mention, but probably should, that Google is defending itself in the Supreme Court this week against Oracle because the 10-year-old litigation that Oracle filed against Google around fair use of Java and modifications to software has now reached the highest court in the land, and a decision in favor of Oracle could really have massive implications for patenting, you know, bits of software.
It could. I'm not one of the people who likes to spread the doom and gloom. The biggest thing I've read is how if this is ruled in Oracle's favor, then Bell Labs will own iOS. No, that's crazy. That's crazy talk. But then again, 10 years ago, thinking that the Supreme Court would be hearing a case where Google wrote its own version of Android in a way so it could work, or its own version of Java in a way that it would work with other existing versions of Java, was crazy talk. So who the hell knows?
Can we all just agree that the Oracle-Google thing has just been drawn out for way too long for a company that, I'm sorry, is Oracle ever in the news in a positive light, or is it all just patent litigation at this point?
Mostly, but Oracle does.
They now control TikTok in the U.S., so that's positive,
that's
I guess,
what I meant,
for them.
Positively.
Well, Oracle is a legitimate company that makes legitimately good products, but their other things they do are so bad that nobody cares how good their products are. They just think of them as evil incarnate.
All right, let's get back to Google here, because I want to focus on what happens next with this after this antitrust report. So it comes out, Jerry. What are the next steps for the House, for Google itself, and for us who are kind of waiting on any changes to these regulations?
I think the biggest changes need to happen in the courtroom. The House is, you know, they're going to take their job as a way to find reasons to separate parts of businesses away from each other. And not just with Google, with Amazon, especially with Amazon and with Facebook. Apple, not so much. But the big thing, our government is in looking at is, you know, these companies all own all these other companies and they all work together, and it's killing competition. And the logical, you know, end point of that is let's break these companies up. I don't see that nearly as helpful as Google getting fined $25 billion for what it's done in India. The courts can fix this.
At the same time, though, how much of this can courts fix, and how much of this is going to be on, like, Congress and the EU creating new legislation to keep them in check? Like, a big portion of the report out this week was advising, okay, here are the things that we need to create legislation to prevent or to fix.
Agreed. That's creating the legislation is important. Doing it the right way is important. But going through and just randomly thinking that, you know, let's just do this, this, and this, and it'll fix everything without making new rules and laws to prevent it from happening again is not helpful.
And, you know, Google's CEO responded to the antitrust report by saying that it features outdated and inaccurate allegations from commercial rivals about search and other services. So what he's saying is that the concerns that a lot of Google's much smaller rivals have raised over the last few years since this report started have been rectified. Google has taken, steps to fix those holes. They've stopped working with third-party vendors that scrape other sites and integrate them into the knowledge graph. They've stopped, you know, gouging people for using their Maps API too much. They've stopped essentially making it difficult for competitors to advertise on search when Google has a competing a competing product. Something that Amazon has also been accused of. And in general, Google has changed some of its search results to make it clearer that ads, that, you know, where something is an ad and where something is not. But there have also been allegations that Google has actually made it harder for some companies to get their own products to rank highly organically on Google search and that they have to pay a lot of money through AdWords to get those products at the top of a search result. You know, there are always two sides of this argument. Yep. And one thing that I found really interesting about the report, so I'll finish Sundar Pichai's statement. He says, Americans simply don't want Congress to break Google's products or harm the free services they use every day, free being the most important phrase there. The goal of antitrust law is to protect consumers, not help commercial rivals. Many of the proposals bandied about in today's reports, whether breaking up companies or undercutting Section 230, would cause real harm to consumers, America's technology leadership, and the U.S. economy, all for no clear gain. And, you know, he is encouraging changes to the laws, but not where it would harm competition. I do want to read something from the report, though, that speaks to what Sundar Pichai was talking about. It's on page 52, and it's talking about Google and Facebook, and it's saying the best evidence of platform market power, therefore, is not prices charged, but rather the degree to which platforms have eroded consumer privacy without prompting a response from the market. As scholars have noted, a platform's ability to maintain strong networks while degrading user privacy can reasonably be considered equivalent to a monopolist's decision to increase prices or reduce product quality. So what they're basically saying is that Google and Facebook offer free services. And in exchange for that, you, the person using those services, are monetized in a way that is not obvious to you, because it's your data that is being monetized, and it's doing so, you know, these companies are doing so behind the scenes. And as we kind of accept all of these encroachments into our privacy in exchange for more and more better free services, that argument that it is equivalent to a monopolist raising prices or degrading the quality of service is it's the same thing or close to the same thing.
Agree.
And seeing it written like that is fascinating, because it really does speak to the fact that Google's services are largely beloved. People love using Google. They make that argument all the time. And why would the regulator break up a company whose products are largely loved and free for everybody to use?
You know, it's our own fault. My fault, your fault, everybody who's listening. I love Google services too. I also very much care about my privacy, but I think that most of Google services offer me so much in return that I will give my privacy away to use it. Each year, each time I see a new agreement that I have to agree to, Google takes a little more. Sometimes they give me a little more, sometimes they don't, but Google does take more each and every chance it gets. And Google knows that data is currency. Your data is what made Google worth almost $1 trillion. So Google's not dumb. They understand that personal information, your own personal data, is currency. So I agree completely with whichever member of Congress wrote that. Bravo. That needs to be in print.
All right. So I think we're done with this topic for now. We will cover this as more comes to light and Congress moves or doesn't move to enact changes to the laws that affect these big tech companies. Obviously, Google has a big week next week. Pixel 5 is coming out on the 14th or the 15th. I forget exactly when. We will have a review for you. Websites are already unboxing their Pixels. We will have our unboxing for you probably by the time you listen to this, which is great. I'm excited about it. I'm legitimately excited about using the Pixel. I always am, and it's a joy, especially when I have a daughter whose photo I take all day, every day. Mm. So we'll have that. We'll also have the OnePlus 8T event next week. That's also on Wednesday. It starts at 11 a.m. Eastern. That will be fun. The OnePlus 8T, it's not the flagship update that we may have been hoping for. There is still the OnePlus 8 Pro for that, but it'll be a nice bump over the OnePlus 8 that was released earlier this year. And then obviously there's Prime Day Tuesday and Wednesday. If you're interested in buying stuff, we will have everything you need to know on AndroidCentral.com. Probably more than you need to know, but we will cover every single deal that's worth looking at. So stick on Android Central for that. We're going to end the show this week, as we do every week, with what's making us happy. Ara, I will let you go first. What is making you happy this week?
They finally released a trailer for the West Wing reunion that they're doing on HBO Max as a, I think it's either get out the vote or something to draw attention to the election, but I'm just a complete and utter sucker for the West Wing. So I'm super happy to see as much of the cast as they could get back together again to stage a reading of one of their more classic episodes.
All right. I'm excited about that. I mean, the world needs some, what's his name? Sorry, Jeb.
I need more Bartlett in my life.
Jeb Bartlett. That's the one. I always forget.
But also Toby and Josh and Donna.
So, you know, everybody knows the words POTUS now, but like the pilot for the West Wing has that amazing scene where like all the staffers are hearing POTUS is down, POTUS is down. And he'd like tripped on a, well,
no, he had an accident while doing a bike ride in the, because the first scene is Sam Seaborn with the escort that he took home.
Yes, and, right.
Because the pager says POTUS was in an accident. But yeah, no, I'm not an
West Wing
nerd.
It's a great show, great pilot, definitely worth watching.
If you need faith in democracy, just watch The West Wing for a few hours and then remember that today is nothing like that.
But today has flies.
I don't think that's going to make people feel better personally. But
you sure can watch flies in live in real time.
All right, Jerry, what is making you happy this week?
Okay, Netflix, but not for the reason you think. Netflix, I love Netflix is what they're doing with their own stuff. Some of their movies have been absolutely winners. But if you've noticed, every few months, Netflix just recycles all the other stuff. And this month, it is just filled with movies that everybody loved. War Games, Fargo, Gran Torino, Poseidon, Cape Fear. These are all movies that are on Netflix right now that you can watch. And I am a sucker for watching a good movie more than once. I'll use War Games as an example. Most people that are into tech have probably seen it more than once. I'll bet I've watched that movie 20 times and we'll watch it again while it's on Netflix this month. These movies are going to go away and get replaced with something else when the next recycle event happens, maybe with something as good or better. But now's your chance. Take this month, watch some of the great movies from the last 15 years or maybe even 20 years that you really loved. And you're what, paying $9 a month to do it?
Yeah. Although my Netflix subscription just went up by $2 today, so I'm not super happy about that.
It's worth it. Just Fargo.
Yeah,
you can watch Fargo. That makes
it worth. I loved seasons 1 to 3, but season 4 just no. I've
no,
heard
the movie Fargo
the movie.
From the 80s.
Oh, okay.
They brought that back.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's one of Coen Brothers' best films. I love it.
Yep.
But also seasons 1 to 3 of Fargo, the show, Noah Hawley, it's a fantastic show. I've just heard that season 4 takes itself too seriously. And like Chris Rock is way too serious where, you know, he doesn't need to be like the character is just not, it doesn't have any like redeeming quality. I don't know. I haven't seen it. So maybe tell me I'm wrong, but not,
you're never
not super
wrong
happy
if it's
about
something
it.
You like.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. So, what's making me happy this week? I'm going to go back to something I mentioned earlier in the show. It's the Remarkable 2. It's that paper tablet. I have just rediscovered my love of physically writing on a, you know, like physically writing, period. I haven't done it regularly forever and I missed it. And, you know, I know it's extremely first world to be saying I missed writing and then doing it on a $400 e-ink tablet. I'm aware of how insane that sounds, but I'm also somebody who lives on his computer all day, every day. I type for a living. This has been a seriously rewarding and nostalgic change of pace for me. And it's a way that I can get my thoughts out physically that in a way that I haven't been able to. You know, I don't like writing on a pen and paper. It's just not something that I've enjoyed for a long time. It hasn't been a part of my routine. This kind of bridges the gap. It all uploads to the cloud, so I don't have to worry about losing the physical pieces of paper. I don't have to worry about actual paper. And it's just great. It's been really, really nice. It's a beautiful piece of hardware, really, really thin. There's almost no latency on the stylus itself. So if you're interested in something like this, I recommend it. And I couldn't recommend the original Remarkable because it was pretty janky, but this one fixes all of the problems of the first one.
Does it use USB-C?
Yes.
And you can, okay. It's the latency's been fixed. You can actually sketch on this one if you wanted to doodle and sketch.
Yeah, I haven't actually sketched, but it does have pressure sensitivity.
All right, you sold me.
So it's probably, I'll try it. I'm no artist, so I can't speak to, you know, somebody having talent to sketch.
How
but
is
I
it
can,
for reading?
It's fine. I mean, it's a bit big for to use as an ebook, an e-reader, but you know, it works fine. It's basically just a really large Kindle.
Well, see, now you've got three people really interested in this thing.
Nah, I'll stick to my Duet and my fan fiction, well, my comics.
Then two people and one. Persnickety? One persnickety person. And then what you called yourself earlier? Persnickety?
Yes.
Anyway,
that's the kinder version of what I'm supposed to say about myself.
You own it. You own that.
Yes.
You own that persnicketiness.
You should be proud to be persnickety. You are
and all just be
it.
Persnickety. All right. We're going to end it there, folks. Thank you so much for listening, Jerry. Ara is at Ara Wagco. Jerry is at GB Hill. I am at Journey Dan. We are at Android Central. As I said earlier, send us email, podcast@AndroidCentral. We love hearing from you. We will be back next week to cover all of the Pixel 5, the OnePlus 8T, and anything else that broke physically and in the news form in the next few days. Have a great week. We will talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.
Adios.